G'day, humans. Well, don't you get a lovely episode today? I've been saving this one up for you. I am on holiday. I'm still working for you because you matter to me, to my heart, to my soul. I'm walking along a street in Hamilton Island. I don't know if you can hear the distant resort music in the background. It is bloody freezing. I've come to Hamilton Island, which is in the Whitsundays on the Great Barrier Reef, for a little bit of R&R with the family. This is our first post-pandemic holiday. And so I thought, look, we're going to escape the Sydney winter and we're going to go somewhere really warm. Here I am on an island freezing my balls off. But there are palm trees and beautiful beaches. So this is the ultimate first world problem. Great interview for you today. It's what I would like to call a comfy couch convo. As you may be aware, if you're a regular listener, uncomfortable conversations are my long form interviews with world leading thinkers and celebrities. And then occasionally we'll sprinkle throughout like little nuts on the delicious sundae that I just ate down at the Hamilton Island Marina. Did I mention I was on holiday in Hamilton Island? Did I make you feel guilty about that? Did I make you feel jealous? Good. Mission accomplished. Occasionally peppered throughout the season of the show will be comfy convos, where I grab a friend of mine and we sit down. We have a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, some cocaine perhaps, and we chat about this and that and anything that's on our mind. This is a corker of a comfy convo. It's with one of my faves, Jesse Stevens, and it's about Botox. It's about lip fillers. It's about the things that we do, especially if we happen to be women, to try to make other people think that we're prettier than we actually are, and what that means for self-image, for social media, and more broadly for feminism. Jesse is the assistant head of content at Mamma Mia, one of the biggest, I suppose, content manufacturing empires in Australia. And she's the co-host of Mamma Mia's flagship podcast, Mamma Mia Out Loud. I hope you enjoy this one. Next time I see you, I'll be back in rainy, cold, freezing Sydney. I hope you and your loved ones are well. Enjoy the one and only Jesse Stevens. Hello, Jesse.
Hello.
You're looking very lovely.
Thank you.
Have you had any plastic surgery lately or any fillers, injections, Botox?
I haven't.
Nips, tuts?
But I will say it started to happen among my friends. So I'm 30.
Right.
And my friends have started saying that they're going to get a little bit of Botox, little bit of filler, a little bit of sometimes they turn up and they have a bit of a different face with new lips.
Do you ask them?
Depends on the friend, but sometimes I do, and I am grappling with this strange feminist moment and trying to work out what I think about it and what to do and facing the realities of aging and whether there is even a choice anymore, because feminism is meant to be a choice. And sometimes I look in the mirror and go, I don't even feel like I have a choice whether to have Botox anymore, because I feel like that's the only way to age.
What?
Yep. That's how it feels.
Get out of town.
Yeah, because my mum.
You're delusional. Why would you feel that way? Why would you feel that way?
Because of
a magazine?
No.
Because of the Kardashians? Have the Kardashians done this to you, Jesse?
Look, probably a little bit, but I've always thought that it's
not. You're going to get bum implants as well?
I'm pretty sure they kill you, but I have never found that it's the Instagram aesthetic or it's the magazine thing. It's your contemporaries that are really influencing you and teaching you how to age. And you're watching people 5 years or 10 years ahead going, how are they aging? How are they doing it? What am I allowed to look like at 35 or 40 or 45?
Mm.
And you have this moment, I think it's in your late 20s, where you suddenly realize that just about everyone, especially on television, has Botox. And I fooled myself into thinking they just aged well and wore sunscreen and drank lots of water. And that's not a fact.
I don't even know the extent to which Botox is widespread, because, I mean, you can tell when you can tell.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, you can tell when it's like Nicole Kidman 15 years ago. Yeah. And it's like, wow, that person has no facial expressions. Or actually, there's a movie on Netflix that's a Helen Hunt film.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen the photos of this?
Yes, I have.
I started watching it and I can't watch the film. It's so distracting. She doesn't look like a human being and she cannot move her face. Like someone's created a plaster cast of Helen Hunt from like the era when she was famous, and they've made a plastic model of it, and they've superimposed that plastic model onto the face of a 100-year-old mummy. Well, a mummy would be older than 100, wouldn't they? A 4,000-year-old mummy. And that mummy is now starring in a Netflix film. It's quite distracting. And there's no reference to it. Like, there's no reference to why this woman looks, why she's been horribly disfigured by plastic surgery.
Yeah, they're trying to play like an average suburban mom. Yeah, that's like, where did you get all that money to do the face? Right,
exactly.
It doesn't make...
In fact, there was a movie... Sorry, I'm just remembering. There was a superhero movie. I think it was Ant-Man 2 or something, where they go down to a microscopic level and his mother has been stranded there for centuries or something. And she's been at the microscopic level and they managed to beam her up into real human life. And the mother is played, I think, by Michelle Pfeiffer.
Oh.
And I did tweet about how it's good that at the microscopic level they still have Botox surgeries, clinics down there, because clearly she has had a lot of work done.
They thought of every detail.
They thought of everything down at the microscopic level. But what? But all of this is a long way of saying, how do you know who's had it if they've had it done well?
So this is what I've discovered, is that the people I thought hadn't had it have had it. And to not have it is an act of rebellion. But there's this new thing called like baby Botox, which is when you get a tiny little bit and you still move. You've got the movement and it's getting... I'm sure the technology is getting better and better. So you can still see movement and their faces move, but it doesn't have the depth of a crease, or it isn't getting, you know, more obvious or whatever it is. And that struck me as worrying, because even the Helen Hunts and whoever else, they're the tastemakers. They're the people who are culturally deciding what we are going to look like as a race. And are they just foreshadowing that's what all of us are going to look like in 30, 40 years?
No. Just as we don't all, like everyone in China doesn't bind their feet anymore. It goes through fads, I think, and like hair color.
True.
We don't have big beehive hairdos anymore. It's just a period of people becoming obsessed with a particular look, I think.
But then
certainly that's true of like lip fillers and things like that, where there's a specific look associated with it that in 30 years I think people will look back and go, what on earth were people doing?
How about teeth? Do you reckon that this thing of big white teeth... That's going to stick? Do you think that's a moment in time, or do you think that's an evolution?
That's a bit trickier, because I think that's actually a national difference in the sense that America has had that for a long time. Britain has never had it, and Australia is now swinging around to...
Trying to.
I think the export of American cultural imperialism is what's imposing fake, really, really fake-looking teeth on the rest of the world. So I don't know whether that'll last. It's certainly...
It's everywhere, and I think it's a marker of health. Like, it's not really, but sort of in this weird, unconscious way, we see big white teeth as health, privilege, class.
Privilege. I think privilege and class are where it's at. I don't think why do you say health?
Because if you see someone with bad teeth, then often it can be seen as like immediately, it's the same actually with someone who's got signs of aging, is you go, oh, that person doesn't look well, is the, sort of the first thing. It's like when a woman doesn't wear makeup for a day and everyone at work buys her flowers because they're like, you have a terminal illness. There's this thing that as we age, or, you know, naturally, that we want to look well and we want to look like we're alive and energetic.
And sprightly and...
Yeah.
But I mean, I think you're missing... There's something in between terrible teeth and blindingly white fake teeth, which is just teeth. You know what I mean? Like, if you have terrible teeth that are all crooked and they're brown, then you look unwell.
Yes.
If you have blindingly white, obviously fake teeth, then you look... like you're trying to project an image of class and privilege and opulence. And I think if you just have regular teeth, just like, you know, not wildly crooked and not wildly grey, but just normal teeth, then I don't think that that registers, unless you're in those circles, like unless you're a Wall Street broker or you're in Hollywood or something like that, where it's mandatory to have the fake teeth, then for me, it doesn't land. I don't notice people who have normal teeth. I notice terrible teeth and I notice the obviously fake teeth.
Yeah, that's true. And I suppose it's to do with class mobility and all that kind of stuff too. Like if you can afford to have your teeth whitened or if you can afford to have the veneers thing, it says a lot about your standing. But I'm interested to see if that's going to be a trend, because even dyeing your hair, like women dyeing their hair, that's been a pretty long, once we could do it, we were like, why would we ever go grey? Mm. And there are some women that do it and they're kind of, and I still think it's quite transgressive. I was going to say same with body hair, but that's also fairly recent, I suppose, the removal of all body hair.
And that, again, I'm sure that that's cyclical. That's not a forever thing. You know, in the 70s, there was hair. I mean, there's less hair. Well, I mean, I don't know now because I haven't been on the dating scene for a while, but like 10 years ago, everyone was shaved, like including their pubes and everything. But 10 years before that, they weren't, when I was just starting to experiment. So, like,
I wonder if it'll come back. But then all the people that got laser.
Well, they shouldn't have gotten laser. No. Don't do something permanent.
Exactly.
She's wax.
Exactly. And now I just feel like you can see certain trends happening, but this thing of and I suppose it's a question of, we've always feared age. Even the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, there's been a thing especially about the old woman. The old woman was the wicked old witch. She was to be afraid of. She terrified men, she terrified children, and she was lonely and in a forest and eating children. So I think that that's what we see when we look in the mirror. And I say this, my mother has never had anything done, and my grandmothers were not vain at all. And I suppose that's why I'm grappling with it, because I'm thinking, is this going to be an inevitability of my generation, that we all get to a certain age and just as you go through other things where, you know, you dye your hair or whatever, we might get to an age and go, all right, this is the age where I'm sitting around a table with 10 friends and 9 of them have Botox and I don't. How strong am I really?
Would you do it?
I would say absolutely not. But then there is a thing about not wanting to be the outlier, and I suppose a competitive instinct and wanting to be part of a tribe and all that kind of stuff.
But those aren't good reasons. I mean, doing it because you feel like, you know, you could use a few fewer wrinkles around your eyes or something might be a potentially legitimate reason if it comes from a place of self-love. But does it? I don't know.
I don't know. Because I worry that for me it's political, and I know a lot of very, very smart, very feminist women who I love who have had work done and it looks great. And for them, it must not be. The decision must not be a political decision. And in the same way they buy a serum or they wax their eyebrows, they're like, well, if there's a solution to this thing I don't like, why wouldn't I do it?
I mean, that's right. It sort of reminds me a little bit of, and maybe it's not a perfect analogy, but like once you reach your 30s and certainly your 40s, you have to start working out and like taking care of yourself and thinking about that in a way that you didn't have to in your 20s. And isn't that vain? I mean, isn't that similar to Botox? Isn't that an attempt? We can couch it in all the language of kind of health and wellness that we want to, but fundamentally, when most of us want to lose weight, we want to do it for vain reasons because we want to look better. We're not doing it because we're, you know, deadly afraid of being wildly unhealthy.
Or because we enjoy running.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Nobody does.
And it is being that language around wellness is interesting, because in fact, I think that the Botox and plastic surgery discussion is being hijacked by wellness, and somehow it's to look after your face or to use certain products, which are all prohibitively expensive, is wellness, is an investment in your health.
Yes, you be you, let yourself shine.
And I've heard it said that
by putting foreign toxic chemicals in,
that we don't really know what it does, but just go for it. And I've heard it said that if a lot of women are doing something and you feel a bit weird about it, look if the men are doing it. And if they're not, then something's going on.
Yeah.
And yeah. something is going on. It's not that no men are getting Botox, because some men are, but not to the same extent. And there is something more broadly about a raising expression and a raising experience that doesn't sit right with me, I suppose. But then I can understand women who say, I am in my mid-40s, I'm applying for jobs and I'm being dismissed because of that I look my age and people think I look tired or they think I look old or whatever it is. And they get it because they feel like they have to. And that to me is a problem.
And then it becomes a question of, are you creating an arms race?
Yes.
Where it's not even just that it's, you know, that there's a gender component, and there clearly is a gender component to the way that we conceive of age, the way that that lands for us. Like, I'm not worried about, like a lot of my friends, including my husband, will like use serums and moisturizers and apply SPF every day. And like they always have kind of vaguely shiny, like shiny gay face, I sometimes call it, like, you know, very well manicured metrosexual or homosexual gentlemen who always look perfectly like
yes.
manicured. And there's
it's
not
like
a
that
single...
face is expensive.
Yeah,
it's
there's
expensive
not an
face.
Eyebrow out of place yep. and the nails are always perfectly clipped and they're just shiny all over. And I'm not. And when they're like, oh, but you're going to get wrinkles. I'm like, you know what? Some of the greatest characters I've ever known have had wrinkly, craggly faces. I'm not afraid of having a crinkly face as a guy. You know, because
yeah.
if you look like Bob Hawke, that's great. That's a face that's seen something. You know, that lands for me as...
more trustworthy and like...
sort of, or just like it doesn't land as being worse than a young face. And I think you're right that there's something about the old wicked witch stereotype or something in the way that we are acculturated to see femininity.
Yeah.
That an old woman's face, I mean, I think there's a beauty in it and I loved my nana's face
yeah.
and I loved every little crease and crevice in it. But you're right that it doesn't come like an unmade up, purely natural old woman's face doesn't land with the same gravitas that an old man's face does. It lands with more pity or more...
It's culturally the butt of a joke. I mean, aging generally is the butt of a joke. And I remember seeing those Prince Philip memes going around about how he'd actually been dead for years and blah, 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 because he looked like a 99-year-old man.
Mm.
The way we talk about older people generally says a lot about us as a culture and, you know, can explain a lot of what's going on in aged care facilities because we have a complete disregard for older people. And I think that might come down to it as well. There's a sort of a lack of respect, the way we value youth. But I've got the same thing with my nana. I remember sitting in her lap and playing with her neck. And that would have probably been quite offensive, but she didn't seem to mind. And you could pull it out. And it would stay there for like, I used to count, it would stay there for like 30 seconds and then go back in. And it was like her whole life story was written in the complexity of her face. But in saying that, I remember her being in hospital. I think she'd had a stroke and catching
well,
her.
Had people pulling her neck skin too.
Yeah, exactly. She just couldn't handle it. And she was in hospital and she couldn't find a comb. And so she found a fork, an unused fork, and was brushing her hair. I was like, how interesting that vanity or how she looked in that moment still did matter a little bit.
Well, maybe it's vanity, but isn't there also, particularly among women of that generation, a sense of sort of quiet dignity and doing things the way things are supposed to be done? Like my nana had that, she would have never... It wouldn't have been, even if there'd been no one to see her, she would have had a certain level of decorum
yes.
about the way that she carried herself and presented herself just for her own
and it's
sense of self.
I wonder if it is about control and feeling, I guess a lot of women's lives, whether it's childbearing or whatever it was, doesn't feel completely in control, but you are. And we even saw that during COVID, like, skincare and skin rituals went through the roof because it was a part of our lives that we could control, even if it was vain and narcissistic.
Mm.
And so I wonder if that's part of it. But ultimately it's to do with, I suppose, our value. And if a woman is 70 or 80 or 90 or whatever, she's no longer a sex object. And so her value, our culture is like, I don't know what to do with that.
I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned like control and self-control. Because the same the thing that is motivating your grandmother to still keep combing her hair, even if all she has is a fork, is also, it also sounds a bit like the kind of advice that you get from the Jordan Petersons of the world, or the general, was it General McChrystal who gave that famous address to the university graduating class where he was talking about, like, make your bed in the morning. Like, if you're not going to do anything else, before you go out and save the world and sign up to, you know, to your activist class to overthrow the patriarchy or the capitalist pigs or whatever, like, make your bed and have a shower. Like, take care of the little things that are within your control. Because you're not going to be any use to anybody unless you can master yourself in the small ways that that make a life sustainable and sort of worth living and effective.
Sylvia Plath had the same in her book, The Bell Jar. That was the advice. She was, you know, deeply depressed, and the psychological advice was put makeup on in the morning and go out, which says something about control and feeling as though I'm going to put my armor on in order to face the world and try and perfect oneself before you try and, you know, affect any change in the world. But is it also a way of, is it also one of the most powerless things we can do? You know, like, is it another way of being subjugated by another set of values? And we think we're making a choice by putting on our makeup and Botox and whatever it is, but really we are completely oppressed by capitalism, by people who are making all this money off women's choices to, you know, invest in themselves and look after themselves, which isn't really, is it making us happy? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. Is it self-mastery, or is it just a different version of being manipulated, just being manipulated by bigger forces than...
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. I've seen Islamists. I follow quite a lot of Islamists on Twitter.
Yeah.
Because I think that it's interesting to actually hear from the horse's mouth what they think about things. And there'll frequently be a meme of like a woman wearing a bikini, a cartoon, for example, of a woman wearing a bikini walking down a beach. And then on the other panel, it'll be a woman in a burqa. And it'll be, you know, it'll say, and they say, you know, and they say, we're cruel to our women or something like that.
Yeah.
Implying that there's an equivalence between requiring women to wear a burqa and expecting women to be okay with showing all of their flesh at the beach. And
it's a fair point.
Well, I mean, I always object to that because if you actually look at what the consequences are for most women in most Muslim countries for not wearing the codes, there are severe, I mean, ostracization from the family, divorce, you know, having no rights, being excommunicated from your local mosque, and in some cases actually being convicted of a crime if you're in places like Iran or Saudi Arabia. So I don't think there's an analogy there, because nobody is being arrested or excommunicated for refusing to wear a bikini on the beach. But I
there's
wonder
social.
Whether you think there's a, yeah, there's a, like, I think they're pointing to at least a tiny kernel of truth, which is that it's not a completely free choice to conform to the norms of the society you live in.
No,
the culture you live in.
There are social consequences that we've internalized, especially heterosexual women, in order to be, you know, appealing to a male gaze. And are we free in those choices? And at least in the 50s, 60s, 70s, when that wave of feminism was coming up, you could point to the home and point to very clear oppressive forces. Like, hang on, I'm not, well, we're still not getting paid the same, but I can't go and get a bank loan. If I'm a teacher and I get married, I'm not allowed to work anymore. That's a clear kind of marker of inequality. These markers are way less clear because there are women going, no, this is my choice. So that's what I'm, is this a new way for the patriarchy to subjugate women under a new set, a new kind of form of oppression? Because the reality is that the more we're, you know, putting into our face, or the more we're staring in the mirror, like, we're not doing other things. And is that a new way to control and reduce women to their bodies under their own, under women's own choice?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's anything new about people being expected to conform to the norms that are imposed on them by the wider culture, but maybe it feels new because the other forms of oppression have been stripped away.
Yes.
So if there are layers of oppression, I mean, it's a good thing that the kinds of oppression we're talking about are so nebulous that we can't even figure out if they exist, right?
Or is it? Like, because is it worse to think that your form of oppression is a choice? Because this is...
No, it's worse to actually be physically prevented from getting the job you want and
this
to actually be legally prevented from divorcing your husband and to, like...
Yeah, I know actual, what you're saying.
You need actual break...
But like, then at back, the same put it this time...
Way, ask someone... Go back in a time machine and ask someone in the 50s what they... A feminist in the 50s, what they really object to, and they're not going to say... You know, the general vague expectation that I look pretty. They're going to say, I want the same rights as men to do the same things that men do. Those are the low-hanging
but
fruit.
But at least they knew what to point at. And I wonder if it gets to a point where you no longer know what to point at. You know you're not happy. You know it's not fair. You know you're spending an hour in the bathroom every morning and your partner's not, or whatever it is. And I know this isn't a matter of life or death, and you're exactly right about that. But is it even more sinister because we can no longer point at it and we can no longer fight on the street because it's become increasingly unclear as to how gender inequality has manifested? And that I find really difficult. I even look at, for example, Chinese foot binding. I always find this fascinating that when they tried to outlaw that, the women were the ones going, please don't outlaw this.
Yeah.
This is part of our culture.
I don't want to have big clunky flipper feet.
Yeah, have you seen those ugly feet those other women have? And it was them that were like, this is part of our culture. This is part of who we are. And it was extremely problematic, I think, for, you know, whether it was white people or whoever to come in and go, no, stop your cultural practice. Because is that any different? We look at Chinese foot binding and we go, oh, how could women put themselves through that pain? And then in, you know, Western culture, we're getting a Brazilian wax. Like, how is that different? Or we look at female genital mutilation. There's obviously a very big difference between being forced. But then you've got women in Western culture who are spending their own money because they're going, I don't think that my genitals are acceptable. And I am willingly, as a choice, getting them changed and going through this extremely painful surgery. So I don't think they're equivalent. But I think there's an interesting argument to be made about oppression.
But at some point, you also have to give women agency.
Yes, exactly.
Like, if they say they want it, what are we going to do? Say that they're not allowed to want it? I mean, Marx dealt with this a lot, Karl Marx, when he talked about false consciousness, and he was talking in the context of the proletariat, like thinking, you know, the working stiff will think that what they want is to get ahead in life and to make money and to get more material acquisitions.
That's all they know, yeah.
But, yeah, actually what they don't realise is that if only they could have my communist utopia, that then they'd want it. But at some point, after, you know, 50 years of eating borscht and wearing Bulgarian shoes, everyone in the Soviet Union was like, fuck this, I actually just want the TV and the Coke.
It's so true. And maybe that's,
you know, they're allowed to who are we to tell them that, who are we to tell women that they can't get their genitals tweaked if it's truly a free, but then what is truly free? But I mean, all you can say is that it's free from overt coercion. Like, none of us is free from subtle coercion, not women, not men, not anything. And by coercion, I mean the expectation, the fact that there will be consequences from you trying to exclude yourself from the norms of the culture that you live in.
And I wonder if the coercion to not look old will become more and more overt. I know it's not going to be Handmaid's Tale style, like an authoritarian regime where you get whipped if you get old. But when there are social payoffs, very real, perceivable social payoffs for making a certain choice, then the question is whether it's free at all. But you're right, it's not.
Well, it's free, it's just weighted, like all choices are.
Yeah.
I mean, and I say this partly from the perspective of the fact that I've got a little bit of a chip on my shoulder about the fact that women who I've worked with, particularly in entertainment and in on-air presentation roles, will hide behind what a hassle it is to have to conform with these norms and then privately express to me how much they love looking nice and presenting well.
Yeah.
And
So I'll, you know, when I was at HuffPost Live, every morning there was one co-host in particular who would just hog the makeup, you know, because you've got two makeup like people, and so if I need to go on the air, I only need 3 minutes. They just need to put some anti-shine on me. But she'd be there. Now, admittedly, she might take 40 minutes or 50 minutes, but she'd be there for an hour and a half because she'd be so particular about exactly what eyelashes she wanted and exactly how she wanted her hair to be done. And then she'd complain loudly about the patriarchy forcing her to look a particular way. I guarantee there was no one would have complained or judged her at all if she'd been in makeup for half the time that she was. She liked it. She loves that. It makes her feel a certain way. Now, is she feeling that way because she lives in a culture where men dictate the expectations about how she's going to look? Maybe. Is she feeling that way partly because she lives in a culture where women are extremely obsessed with how she looks?
I don't think you can just blame the patriarchy or the male gaze.
And is she maybe just a bit vain and she'd be doing vain things even if she was in a tribal culture, even if she was living in an Indigenous Australian community 80,000 years ago? Would she be the one who's always like trying to come off the best? I don't know.
Or has she internalized that to such a degree? It's like, you know, when women are at home and have to wear makeup, or there are instances of you know, being alone with no one watching you, but you still feel watched. And that's because we've internalized this kind of policing or surveillance that we get socially all the time. And so has she just internalized that to such an extent that she's terrified, of judgment? Is she getting off and reading 100 comments of people saying how ugly and old she looks? Whatever it is, it could be that. And even the fact that a man still, we talk about equality, needs a bloody powder to go on air. And then women, and it's so impossible to untangle, because if you said to every woman on television tomorrow, okay, 3 minutes you've got for a bit of a powder before you go on air, they'd go, no, 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 no.
Yeah.
They'd be terrified because they know the social payoff. They're also, it's habitual, it's cultural, it's there's a million other things at play. But that's such a disparity in how we function and the time that a man might get to do other much more fun things and sit in the makeup chair.
Exactly, that's right. Speaking of coming back to teeth whitening, there's an ad in the States, or there was when I was living there, that I thought was so bizarre. It's two teenage girls, and one of them is looking at her teeth in a little portable mirror that she's pulled out of her handbag, going like, oh no, look at my teeth. They look terrible. And her friend goes, why don't you take the tissue test? And she goes, what? The tissue test. Take the tissue test. And she holds up a tissue, a blindingly white tissue, and holds it next to her teeth and goes, the tissue test. It's how you know if your teeth look sparkly white. And she holds it up and like, and then it goes to the, it's for like a whitening strip that you can buy at the chemist. And
that erodes your enamel.
And, yeah. And they are advocating, like, they are advocating that you test whether or not you need this product by holding the whitest thing that you can get your hands on, a tissue, next to your teeth. Your teeth aren't supposed to be the color of a tissue. Your teeth are supposed to be mother of pearl or off-white or cream colored. They're not the color of a tissue.
That ad would have planted a seed for a generation, I reckon, that would still have it in the back of their head. Every time they pick up a tissue, they'd go, oh, I should really ease off that red wine or whatever it is. Like, that plays in the back of your mind, and advertisers know that. That is very...
Totally. I mean, they're making you feel like the way that you're built, the way, like the ideally perfectly healthy person is dysfunctional.
Yes, and it's still not enough. Than.
Yeah. So is sexiness sexist?
No. I don't know. I don't think so. Because I think there is actually something very primal about the desire to appeal to the opposite sex in both genders. And I think that men do it as much as women in a lot of ways. But I think that it's when it infiltrates, and this is the thing, and then it gets really complicated. I'm thinking about the ridiculousness of being at an all-girls school and the way in which the male gaze infiltrates that community, and it becomes about how you look and comments about your appearance in the same way. And so that's already been internalized by, you know, a bunch of 16-year-old girls that you ought to look a certain way or you're not going to be accepted. And that's not, if you're a straight girl, that's not about sexiness.
Right.
So it's, I think that that's really complicated, but I think that we do a lot of things to try and attract. I think a lot of women have an idea of what the male gaze is that actually isn't correct either. That you're trying to do a certain thing and do a certain dance and fit into a certain mold that actually the men you want aren't looking for.
Well, it depends what men you want.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the way...
Any of the good ones that aren't looking for that.
Exactly. I think it can take people a long time to realize that. But I guess there is something primal, as you say, and grooming is as old as humans are.
Mm.
But it's when we're resisting the passage of time that I start to get a little nervous.
Okay, before you get Botox, will you text me?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm going to go, should I do it? Should I do it?
Yes, come back on
and
the
then
show.
You'll come back with some Marxist analogy and I'll be like, you know what? Don't worry about it.
I just wanted to look. Shut up. Thank you, Jessie.
Thank you.